Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and you are listening to episode 193. We're closing in on episode 200. And this episode that we're doing today should have happened probably earlier in the year. It was our intent to happen, but I'm very happy to welcome back to the show, good friend of the show and fellow podcaster of the Comic Shenanigans podcast, Mr. Adam Chapman. Welcome back, Adam.
Welcome back. That's such a great welcome. I feel so honored and privileged and a little bit embarrassed, but thank you very much for having me back.
We should have, we had intentions of doing this in the very jump off of the new year, and for some reason we just couldn't get our scheduling right, but I think now with a little bit more downtime that's occurring with everything in the world, we might be able to sneak in a couple more episodes. But you're Mr. Podcast Superstar when it comes to the comic book podcast realm. You got all these guys on there, these legends and modern day superstars. It's hard to fit into your schedule, dude. What's on the docket for Comic Shenanigans recently or upcoming?
Recently we had Scott Dunbier on the show, who's the guy who is the mastermind behind the artist collections or the artist editions at IDW. In fact, as I'm sitting here recording, I still have some of the material I had out from that conversation. So I have my two artist editions in front of me right now, which are the Gil Kane Amazing Spider-Man and the Daredevil Born Again, which Scott did confirm is the best-selling artist edition that there is. I also recently had Judd Winnick back on the show. I think it was his third or fourth visit. He's just a fantastic guest. We have him on annually because he has a cartoon series coming out. Not cartoon, sorry. It's a comic book, but it's a graphic novel more geared towards a younger set called Hilo. I just had the sixth book, and so we had him on because every year when a new volume hits, we have him on the show, and that's always just so much fun. He's such he's basically a great hang. Like, it just feels like we're just shooting the shit, and which is the nicest way of having one of these conversations with a pro. And then I also had Tom Brevoort recently on the show, and that's always a lot of fun. It was only the second time I've had him on the show, but it was I think it was almost 2 hours long. Like, I'm just, the thing that blows me away about some of these people is just the amount of time and their graciousness at being able to share so much. Yeah. And really kind of plumb into their minds. And in terms of upcoming stuff, nothing currently on the docket. Actually, I'm gonna have to kind of figure out some ideas, but we're working on, at some point hopefully in the next month, having Mark Waid back on the show to talk on a recent project that he did, which was the history of the Marvel Universe. It was a great 6-issue miniseries, which is now in the Marvel Treasury edition, a kind of oversized soft cover, which is absolutely gorgeous. So he's hopefully going to be on there to talk about that. And then this guest that I've been trying to get for so long, and every time we get close, I think we're almost there, and then it just kind of flies away, which is very fitting because his name is Andy Runton. He's the creator of the Owly book series that was a really big hit in the kind of early to mid-2000s, and then it just kind of went away. It wasn't really around. And then recently, they've actually started bringing all those books back. I think it's a partnership with Scholastic, but now they're all colored. They're originally in black and white. And the whole genius of Owly was that it was this big owl. It was a big-hearted character, and he just made friends with people, but there was no words in any of the books. It was all talking through symbols, and it was very, I always thought it was really a good way to kind of learn the comic book medium, learn the flow of panels, but also not having to worry about words. It was great for younger readers. Well, this new one actually has some dialogue now, but it's the old stories. So the old stories are now colored, and now there's dialogue, which is kind of an interesting inversion on the original kind of conceit of the book. So I really want to talk to him on the show. We keep getting close. I'm hoping that in the next couple months, we finally have Andy Runton on. I just blabbed for way too long, so I apologize for that very long plug for my show, Comic Shenanigans.
Hey, I asked the question for a reason, right? So that's good. It's always nice to know what else is out there for people to possibly listen to, because, I mean, I always love another good comic book podcast to tap into, because I have a lot of opportunity at work to have my headphones in or my radio on, and I can listen to people chit-chat, which I find I appreciate a little more as I get older, more than having music blasting all the time. I think I've passed that stage where I just enjoy conversation about things that I'm interested in more than just, the latest music that came out that I don't have the patience for anymore because I'm old and grumpy now.
You know, it's funny. For the last 3 weeks, like, I've been working from home, and I find, because I don't want to be too, like, you know, antisocial. I find I'm not listening to as many podcasts because usually I'm at work, I'll put some headphones on and I'm in my office, I'm doing my thing, and then I'll take them off when I need to make phone calls, et cetera. But generally speaking, I have, you know, some time to listen to my podcast. Now I'm sitting at my dining room table. I have my wife not maybe 12 feet away, but she's at a, you know, at our main desk and computer area working on her own projects for work. And my son's running around, and I find I don't really have the same level of concentration to kind of put on, listen to this, kind of losing myself to whatever podcast I'm listening to while I do my work. So I'm kind of missing that aspect of it because I'm still working full time from home. I just not, you know, working in a suit anymore, but, you know, still not working in my jammies, unfortunately. I mean, some days I think about it, but I'm like, no, I'm not going to go down that route. I'm still going to be professional.
Yeah, no, it's true. I thought with, all this downtime you'll have, even, you know, I'll watch all these movies and binge all these series and listen to every pod. And it's, I'm reading more comics. I'm rewatching some comfort movies to kind of, you know, help yourself cope with the new normal. And playing Scrabble with my wife because she's home as well. So I don't have headphones in because I just feel like it's one thing for me to read, but I can lift my head up from a book at any moment, as opposed to when you have headphones, it's very like I'm separating myself from what's happening here. So, yeah. So I'm looking forward. That's the one thing when I do go back to work, which is going to be this week, because my job is considered essential, quote unquote. I'll be listening to a lot of podcasts with no interruptions because I'll be in rooms working on installing pipe and plumbing, where no one can bother me or help me anymore, because that's got to be the new normal. So I'll have a lot of that, I guess, opportunity to catch up on old friends and their podcasts, if you will. So I got the Brevoort podcast already lined up. It's what I'm listening to right now. So that'll be my first thing off the list to listen to.
Well, I mean, obviously this is very self-aggrandizing, but I think it was a good one. I think it was an interesting conversation. We do talk about – it was interesting because when we started talking about it, like we did this recording, I guess, last Tuesday, and everything changes day by day, obviously. So the news was still relatively fresh at the time. So we spent the first 10, 15 minutes just talking about the fact that, you know, no new comics are being published and that they were still working on stuff. And this is before they announced that they were, you know, stopping work on some of their product, because obviously they had to. Otherwise, you're going to have this crazy pipeline of stuff. But, like, how do you get it all published? You have to pay people for it. Like, it's this crazy scenario that the industry's in. And so we were kind of a little bit too early to have gotten his response to that, because that hadn't happened yet. But it was interesting to kind of see it in hindsight that obviously things were in the gears, but obviously he couldn't talk about it. But it was like, again, just a week after we found out there weren't going to be any comics. There's some interesting stuff in there about, you know, just Tom's relationship with comic stores, which I thought was interesting. Like, he's an executive editor at Marvel. So I was curious, like, what does him going to a comic store look like? Which maybe sounds silly, but, like, you know, people are going to know who you are.
Yeah, or at least
the people who work there are going to know who you are, because you're one of the movers and shakers in the industry. So I found that part was kind of fun, because, and I don't think you ever get that side, like, no one ever interviews someone about that. And so I was glad to have some of that in the interview, where it's not something you're ever going to be, you know, see Tom Brevoort talking about on a Newsarama interview or whatever. Like, they're going to be talking about the new product and new this, do that. They're never going to be talking about, what's it like to go to a comic book store, Tom?
Yeah,
like,
you're still a fan.
I got to do that. So
yeah,
that was fun.
Exactly. Like, they're still fans themselves, and they love, you often heard, I remember interviews with Dan DiDio. He wasn't ignorant to Marvel. Like, he was a Marvel fan. As much as he was the one of the bosses at DC, he was very aware of things that they were doing and appreciated things that they did. And you have to, right? You have to pay attention to, even just as a fan, there's nothing wrong with enjoying a good story. And it's cool to hear what it is that they like outside of just pumping out their product or selling their product, right? It's cool.
Oh, for sure. Like, when we talked to Tom, he basically said that, like, when there was no comics in the stores last week, or actually, I guess the last couple weeks, but nothing at all. Like, at least they were doing, like, curbside, or, like, you could somehow get a comics. But obviously last week was the first week you couldn't, which was, I guess, April 1st. He was saying how, like, that was basically his first time not going to a comic store on a Wednesday in, like, 30-something years. Like, wow. It was just part of his habit for as long as he ever could. And then suddenly to not have that felt weird, and it was like an alien feeling. And I think everyone's kind of going through that weird sense of withdrawal if you're a Wednesday warrior, that you're like, what am I doing? Where's my comics? Like, where there's no articles about the, you know, the best reviews and all this stuff. Like, none of this, there's nothing out there. It's such a strange environment. It's kind of like if you're working in sports right now, what are you talking about?
Yeah,
like, nothing. There's nothing to talk about. Everything's over.
Yeah, it's true. Well, that's the one thing that at being at home, and I mentioned this to you when we were chatting over text, like right now I'm appreciating some of the things in my collection that I wouldn't normally pick up and read because I'm usually reading it on the go. And, it, you know, they're just easier to pick up a trade or, you know, a soft cover collection where now I'm actually trying to dig out those omnibus and I have a place to rest them and I can enjoy reading a full on story. And it's kind of nice to have that. I'm not happy about the fact that things are shut down or that I can't go and pick up new comics or visit my comic shop and just meet up with the guys. But I do enjoy the fact that, okay, take a breather, Eric. You don't have to buy something new every week and you can read the stuff that you've accumulated and enjoy your collection for once with some downtime. So that's been kind of nice.
It's funny, the first week that I was at home, I bought a bunch of trades I did not need. I was just like, I need to buy something.
Yeah, it's not, I don't know. I went to BMV right before my company shut down for those first 2 weeks when everything was really starting to happen. And I snuck in a BMV visit. I got a couple of trades, a couple of things that I'm like, I don't know the next time I'm going to be able to come here because it could shut down tomorrow, everything. So I got my fix in. And I have the comic book shop across the street, like everyone knows, I often mention, and they're doing curbside pickup right now. So there's nothing new, but there's some stuff that I know is in, you know, in the store on the shelf because I'm very familiar with what they've got all the time. So I'm like, all right, take those off the shelf for me. I'll pick that up now, sort of thing, to keep the business going as best as you can contribute, I guess.
Oh, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So the idea for this episode was partly inspired or very much inspired by everything that's happening right now. And I'm thinking this would feel like an event where you would need an Avengers or a Justice League to step in and figure something out so that we can get rid of this thing. So I said, what are some top event comics through our history of reading that we might want to either recommend or just favorite comics that at the end of the day were they changed our reading experience, changed comics, or just a good uplifting story. So this is going to be top five comic book events. Now, was this hard for you to come up with?
It was hard for me to whittle it down. Like, okay. I've read a lot, right. so that wasn't that hard. Yes. Like in compiling a kind of a master list and then starting to kind of whittle it down from there. That was the easy part. And then I was like, oof, like, you know, what actually makes in the list? And I was like, okay, I'm not going to number my list. I'm just going to have them unnumbered in the five. And some of them I'm going to freely admit, you need hardcore nostalgia goggles to really enjoy them as much as I do. But it just kind of, there's something about when I read it really hits the sweet spot. It reminds me of a time and place, or just, you know, there's just something about it that takes me somewhere and I'm happy to go there, no matter how many times I read it, which is, you know, it's kind of like you said with your comfort food movies. Some of these events are kind of like comfort food. Some others are just so sprawling that you almost, you have to respect the audacity of the creators involved and really go along with the ride. There's one, so I actually have six prepared because one I think is a bit of a cheat. Technically speaking, on the Marvel wikis, it does classify it as an event, but it's more thematic and not in the way we would usually think of it. So it's a cheat, but that's what I'll lead off with.
Okay. So what constitutes an event for you? Because I ask this question because sometimes something could have been maybe a mini series or even a storyline that over time you start to feel is an event because it's something like maybe a Dark Phoenix saga. It's not really an event, but you look back on it and it's this one story that is, it changes everything in throughout the Marvel universe in a way. There's like a touchstone point to it. So did anything that was maybe a team story like the Kree-Skrull War or the Defenders Avengers, would you consider that an event or did it have to be like Infinity Gauntlet or Crisis on it, something very like it was titled something and it had specific issues?
I think generally speaking, most of the ones that ended up on my list, kind of my short list, definitely were more crossovers. They were less one title centric because it didn't really feel like enough of an event, and I was hard pressed to kind of find one that it really felt qualified as an event. Now, I also came of age in the kind of the event period. Like, I'm born in 83, so when I've really started reading comics, I'm reading them in, like, 95, 96, and we're in Event City. Yeah. So I feel like my interpretation of what an event is, off, you know, kind of comes off of that feeling. And even when I first started buying, you know, my earliest trades in the late 90s, I was buying, like, X-Men trades of events. So I was being, like, Mutant Massacre, which, again, was a crossover of many different books. Same thing with, like, Inferno, Extinction Agenda, Extinction mm-hmm. Song. So you had these types of things. So those there's an element of crossover of some kind that kind of meant it needed to be an event. Now, the more modern interpretation of an event is that you have an event series, and then you have other books that kind of tie into it that create, you know, the backbone for this other grander thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's all valid. I think that definition of event has definitely changed over the years, because it used to be, you know, kind of an event that would go through many different books, like Operation Galactic Storm, which went through a ton of different books. Whereas nowadays, it's more you have a main miniseries and then all these other tie-ins. But that was, generally speaking, what I kind of went into this with. I didn't really look at any books that were just, this is one title and this is the event. That didn't really work for me.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I was thinking about that because when I pitched the idea to you, and I said to myself, I don't know if I've definitely read a lot of events, but then I forget as well that, wait a second, Executioner's Song was an event, and Extinction Agenda was an event, and the Fall of the Mutants, and the entire X-Men line was basically one event after the other, because they crossed over into each other all the time. So I'm like, yeah, you've read a ton of events, it's just how do you classify them?
Oh, for sure. And I mean, and probably you've read a lot of the kind of modern ones, like the early to kind of, I guess, late 2000s were just riddled with one event after another. It was just like, oh, you got Avengers Disassembled? Okay. Well, now you got House of M. You enjoy House of M? Okay. Now we got, Secret Invasion. Did you like that? Okay. Now we're going to have Siege. Like, it was just, or there's, you know, World War Hulk. Like, every year there was some other big event. So it was this constant treadmill of what's the next big event to get you to the next one, which kind of burnt me out on events for a long time. And I think the last one I really kind of wholeheartedly bought into was AVX. And that was probably the be all end all in terms of how many tie-ins, the metric ton of content. And I think I remember we did an episode very early on in the podcast. I want to say it was like episode 20 or something. It was in the first year, I think, where my brother-in-law brought over all his singles. And I had told my other buddy, Nathan Struck, who's been on the show in the past, although it's been a while, that we were going to do this episode. And so he read the 12 issues of, or however many it was, of AVX. And then in comes Paul with this entire like short box of every tie-in. And I remember Nathan just being like, what the hell is going on? Like, are we really going to talk about 70 books? The answer was yes. Yes, we were. And it was crazy. So yeah, these things have changed. But I think that was the last time where I really bought in, like kind of bought everything or bought a lot. I definitely enjoyed Secret Wars, which was by Jonathan Hickman. But that might've been the last real event I really enjoyed and felt like it was worthy of being an event.
Yeah. I think I agree with you on that. There was a lot that you mentioned there that I either wasn't reading or collecting those particular books at the time, or because of the event fatigue and sometimes the way that it ruins the other comic books that are being published at the time, sometimes it makes you have a bit of a resentful feeling towards it. I remember that's something that Jerry Conway said, that he hated events when we had spoke, because he was forced to, you know, tie his current book that he was working on with something that was happening that completely threw off the narrative of where he was going with something, because they needed to do this company-wide thing to, you know, boost sales for that Sugar Rush moment. But it was like the thorn in a lot of creators' sides, because a lot of people may have, let's say, a Miss Marvel, for instance, and suddenly she's got to do a tie-in for Civil War II. And it just takes you, the reader, who doesn't care perhaps for Civil War II, for Miss Marvel to head in that direction as well. So it has a positive and negative aspect to it. But let's get into our lists. So what was the first thing?
Yes. Sorry, I got to say one thing there. Yes. I don't think anyone in comics is probably more irritated and has been more screwed over by crossovers and having to capitulate to their whims than Peter David. That guy has been involved in so many crossovers, and so many of his events or his stories have been waylaid by them. So I feel like if there's one, you know, if crossovers had an enemy, it would be Peter David.
Yeah.
And that they keep turning the screws to him.
Yeah, and I think there's a value to it, but when you're editing people to write to that thing, it can really ruin a good thing that you've got going for the long term. But let's get into our things that we like. What's that first one that you've got on your list in no particular order?
Well, actually, before I say it, people who know me would expect me to include one thing in particular, which I did not include. And I decided that, you know, it just wasn't going to fit on my list. It wasn't really was what I was going to go for. But one thing I have to at least mention is the Spider-Man Clone Saga. I did not put it on my list for an event because I don't think it was really an event. I mean, it just went on too long. It was this gigantic thing in time. It's not really an event, but I also feel like in some ways it is.
It's a saga.
Retrospectively.
It's a saga.
Yeah, it was a saga. Retrospectively, it's an event, but really at the time, it was just this thing that kept going forward.
Yeah, I think if an event should last a few months, that lasted, what, 2 years?
Something like that.
Yeah, so the saga tagline, I think, is appropriate for it. That's another one. What are your favorite sagas? Yeah, right? That would be a lot harder, but there'd be a couple to fit into that category as well.
Well, actually, one of the ones that on my list when I get there could theoretically just be called a saga, but I feel like it would, when it happened, it felt like an event in a way that the Clone Saga didn't, because the Clone Saga was this thing that, like, it was, oh, this is cool. Oh, it's still going. Okay, it's still going. Okay, I'm not going to read comics for a while. I'll come back in a year. It's still going.
Yeah.
Whereas the other one I'm going to mention later, it felt like this is happening. This is going to be exciting. And then eventually it would end, but it was long.
Okay.
That's me teasing for later in this podcast.
Okay. Okay. Got it. So shall we proceed?
Yes. So I actually did a quick little check as we were getting ready to actually start talking about this stuff. And I realized that most of these I've actually done flashback episodes of my own podcast about, which is totally incidental.
Okay.
So I have in some ways talked about some of these before, but if you don't know my podcast, that's okay. You're going to hear me talk about them all anew. So the first one, which I think is a cheat, but it was an event, definitely billed as it, was the Marvel Flashback event of 1997. Are you aware of this, Eric?
I remember seeing these issues in all of the Heroes Reborn, if I remember correctly. There was always a flashback issue in whether it was the Captain America, the Avengers, what else was there at the time? I think Iron Man, Thunderbolts had an issue for this. Am I correct? Am I remembering it correctly?
Well, it's actually interesting. So all the big Marvel heroes you mentioned did not get one because they weren't part of the Marvel Universe at this point in time.
Okay.
But, yes, the one you did mention, I forget which one you said, but one of the ones you mentioned, the Thunderbolts one did happen, yes, but okay. Everyone else did not.
Okay, so is this collected anywhere that we could read it?
No, and you can find some of them, like, on, like, I don't know if they're on Marvel Limited because I don't have it, but I know on Comixology that some of these have shown up. They're hard to find, but really, it's a thematic thing. So the whole idea was that for 1 month, every comic book in the Marvel Comics line, well, most of them, the ones that were proper by Marvel, not being housed to farmed out to the Image guys, you got, you know, a minus one issue. So instead of getting whatever issue you were supposed to get, you got this other issue that was minus one, and everything was supposed to take place prior to the first issue of that character's original series. And you had a character of Stan Lee showing up in the middle of, like, the first page. Usually it was like whatever the cliffhanger was in the previous issue. You had Stan kind of bursting through the page, and then it takes you to an adventure in the past. Everything was kind of done in a more of an old school style. They were all done in one stories. And there's just something very heartwarming about most of these adventures. Some of them have little connective tissue to whatever was going on at that point in time in those books. And there's a lot of these, and they're a lot of fun, and they're easy to find in dollar bins, because, again, and they're really well read because they're just, you know, done in ones. They don't have to be read with knowing other things in what was going on at that time. As long as you know anything about these characters, you should have enough to go on.
I think I remember seeing that also in the Silver Surfer epic that I recently read. I think he had a flashback as well.
Yes, I think that was included there. Yeah, and again, a lot of the stuff you had, you know, fun kind of old school art. You didn't see a lot of artists doing more of a modern take. You had a very kind of classic interpretation. The Silver Surfer issue you mentioned was written by J.M. DeMatteis with artwork by Ron Garney, so it was definitely during that run. And again, it was more of an old school flashback story. And it was, you know, a lot of these, again, they're not necessarily important in the terms of, you know, continuity hasn't mined these stories, but a lot of them are fun. Some of them are silly. Some of them do actually add something to the character's backstory, like that's meaningful. I thought the Cable one definitely did that. It definitely felt like it added something to that character. It was in between issues of, I think, Operation Zero Tolerance was just happening at the time. And then you have this old school Cable story about how Cable, you know, first comes to our timeline at one point. It's written by James Robinson, who's, again, that's important. Most of these books were written by the regular creative team. You had LeDron doing the pencils. He does such a great kind of Jack Kirby take on Cable. So it's a lot of fun. Again, a lot of the stuff here is just a lot of... It just makes me feel like what comics are supposed to be, like old school comics, just telling you a fun yarn. It's a done in one. And again, some top notch artwork, some great writing. This is, you know, one of those kind of diamonds in the rough of the late 90s.
Do you think that they'll ever collect this? Can it be collected as like a flashback complete collection, even though they're one and dones, or there it's more thematic than it is a through line plot? What do you think people would go for it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm always surprised that they haven't done stuff like having like a large Assistant Editor's Month complete collection or something like that. Like these thematic collections that I think people would buy. This one, I think more so, because again, there's less of a need to understand what's going on in those books. I mean, you have one page that might confuse you, and then you're going back into the past and you're having a nice, fun story. Like, I would totally buy this. I'm trying to think how many of them there are. Because there are a number of them, because again, it was like their entire line at the time. It would almost take two volumes, but again, they're fun done in one stories. And you know, some of them are, again, on the sillier side. Some of them have just, you know, fun. Like there's one with the Amazing Spider-Man one just had Peter Parker, you know, being a big comic book fan and like reading all his comics. Like, it's just fun stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, they do a lot of the What If collections, right? People absolutely love that series, and many of those stories were just one and done, if not all of them. So why wouldn't this work out in that same sort of capacity?
Yeah, I don't know. What If is at least an established brand that people know, right? Mm-hmm. At least now. And there was two, you know, really long running What If volumes, and so they kind of, there's a built in audience for that. Whereas something like Flashback, there really isn't. They don't know who's going to pick this up or who's going to even remember what it was, because it was not a very, you know, well-remembered time in comic books. A lot of people are like, comic books in 1997, stay away from that. Now, I would say 95, 96 is probably a little bit worse, but 97, like, you're starting to come out of, you know, the overproduction glut where you just had so much material, and sometimes the talent pool got a little shallow.
Yes, I mean, looking back, I remember going to a comic book shop. This is a tangent, but it was in Florida, and it was a house that was converted into a comic book shop where it was just back issues, and anything you wanted to find basically was there as far as like 90s and 80s books, a couple of prestige books that were hanging, you know, behind the counter. But I had found a Death of Superman polybag for $1. And even that still can go for a $10 price tag here and there. It's not out of the ordinary to see that. So I said, how come this is $1 now? This used to be, you know, $100. So people were going crazy for this. He's like, anything from the 90s is worthless. And the overproduction perhaps is the reason as to why. But looking back, letting go of that sort of... what's the word, that opinion that is pervasive that everyone had for a little bit. In 1997, once you had Heroes Return, those books are still top quality books. I don't care what anybody says. That's one of the best creative times, I think, for Marvel, coming out of what was maybe, you know, slumming it for a bit as far as getting their characters where they wanted them to be. But all of those omnibuses that they're putting out omnibuses for those runs for a reason, because it's good stuff. So I defy anybody that says 97 wasn't good comics.
Yeah, you know what it is? People remember the leather jackets and like the homogeny of like the Avengers books, and they're just kind of like, oh, that's not good.
Mm-hmm. But Kurt Busiek and George Perez on Avengers is the best Avengers, I think.
So when I talk about you get some crazy diamonds in the rough here in this flashback. So for example, Uncanny X-Men -1 or -1 flashback. It's written by Scott LaBelle, but it's, you know, it's got art by Brian Hitch. Like, did you ever think Brian Hitch did X-Books for a little while? Like,
yeah.
He was kind of bouncing here and there. So you got him on there. Like, you have, and he's no slouch. Over on, I think X-Men, I think you had Carlos Pacheco, who was the regular penciler at that time, but again, still was cranking out great work. Like, there's a ton of these, you know, really top shelf guys that doing, you know, the work at the time, and people forget.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely. I agree. I mean, even J.M. DeMatteis on Silver Surfer with Ron Garney, like, that's awesome.
Sure. Forgotten. And like on the Wolverine one, you had Cary Nord. I think on the Daredevil one, you had Gene Colan, because I think he was doing the book at the time. Like, again, there's some really fun stuff, and you just gotta, you know, be willing to take a shot. And again, this is not hard to find stuff. You can find a lot of these flashbacks. There's some that will be a little harder to find. I remember I picked a lot of them up in the dollar bin in like 2002, because again, no one cared. No one wanted, you know, and again, because they were -1, it wasn't like anyone was like, oh, I need to have a complete run. This was, you know, an incidental issue that didn't really add to anything. One of the definite gems here is the Untold Tales of Spider-Man one, which is available in an omnibus, and it's an early just kind of story of Richard and Mary Parker, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Super fun, and it's penciled by John Romita Sr.
Cool. That's very cool. Yeah.
And written by Roger Stern.
Yeah, that's very cool. That definite diamond in the rough, for sure. I like it. Good pick. At first, when you said it, I was like, do we even know what this is? But I remember it, and now that you bring up a lot of the creative teams, that would be a pretty cool collection to have. I like it. What do you got next?
Okay, so mine are no particular order, and I'm going to try and get the more obvious ones for who I am out of the way first. So I'm going to talk about, let me think, all right, it's definitely an event, but maybe not in the way we're used to it now, but that's X-Men The Age of Apocalypse, because, like, that's a massive undertaking. Every X-book gets canceled, gets relaunched, there's a 4-issue miniseries of each one, but it's all part of this overarching event. With this whole new world, I'm still surprised that they were ever able to pull this off. First of all, at the time, everyone actually thought that they were canceling the books. People were like losing their shit. That was never going to happen. They were always going to bring it back. But at the time, people seemed to be like really buying into this hype that, you know, something bad is going to happen. We're going to get rid of all the, you know, top selling X books. What does this mean for everyone's runs? All this stuff. And then you relaunch everything. Everything is, you know, I feel like everything that Age of Apocalypse did has been tried to be duplicated so many different times, but never as successfully as the first time. So this time you have, you know, these writers working together, creating a cohesive whole that you have all these different miniseries that kind of spin out from this main kind of alpha one shot, but everyone has their own objectives. Every team ends up having a part to play in where you end up in the final issue and when it all comes crashing down. And it's so much fun. I own it way too many times. I own it digitally. I own the original singles. I own the complete epic trade paperbacks they did in the mid-2000s. I did not buy the most recent or kind of recutting of it. I do have the really shitty prelude, which is actually Legion Quest, which is a separate story, but it had bad printing quality. They used like matte paper. It wasn't glossy. Even the original wasn't glossy in 1995, but somehow 20 years later, they couldn't replicate that. And then eventually I couldn't help myself when they finally reprinted the omnibus. I did pick up Age of Apocalypse in omnibus, just so I can have the big beast. And it solves a lot of the original printing problems in the complete epic Age of Apocalypse trades I have. I love this. Have you read this?
I have read this. It's a fantastic pick, and I have omnibus envy right now because I have it in the recut format that they came out with recently of the complete collection. So I have all of those, and I read it then, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I felt, well, I have those, so I don't need an omnibus. But lately, I have been wanting omnibuses of everything that I really, really love. So hopefully they reprint that again, because now on Amazon it is $250. And I had
holy shit.
Yeah, it's out of print again, I think. So I saw it at my comic shop a couple years ago. He had like a fire sale that he cashed in on from Diamond, and he had Age of Apocalypse there for $75. I never bought it because I'm like, I have it. No need. So, but now I'm regretting it. And that's a great pick. This is a story I think that everybody, again, a perfect example of comic books in the 90s setting the mark, the benchmark high that they have not been able to duplicate, and they keep trying to duplicate it, and it just cannot be done.
No, so to set the stage, I was 11 years old when most of these issues were coming out. I wasn't really buying comics. I didn't know what a comic book store was. I'm pretty sure I only ever saw comic books sometimes at a like local Shoppers Drug Mart, sometimes at my corner store at the foot of my street, and sometimes when I would go to like a super center, and they would have some comics next to the magazines, and that's where I would go whenever my parents would go grocery shopping. So I remember picking up some of these issues when they first happened, but again, not really knowing much about them, but just being in awe of the artwork. I didn't really know much about the X-Men except for the fact that I've been watching the animated series for like 2 or 3 years at this point, because this came out kind of late 94, early 95. So I remember like the first issues I bought at Astonishing X-Men number one. I think I bought Amazing X-Men number one. I'm trying to think what else I had back then. I had Weapon X number two, like just smatterings here and there. I think X-Man 3 or 4, Astonishing number 4. Like, I only had smatterings, and then other people at school would have smatterings, and I'd see parts of it here and there. So I didn't really experience the entire event as it was occurring, but I was just so in love with, like, everything's just so edgy and cool. Art was obviously a high point kind of in the 90s. It was maybe not the best storytelling, but definitely great, you know, kind of pinup art, that kind of stuff was definitely big.
Yeah.
So I just really fell in love with it. And then a couple of years later, I want to say in like 99, my local comic book store, there used to be another Silver Snail in Toronto at Yonge and Eglinton. And they were having a huge sale, and I bought like, you know, $80 worth of back issues of just Age of Apocalypse for like 15, 20 bucks. And so I kind of was able to kind of pad out the collection and finally have it all. And I just loved it. And I never really got tired of it and loved reading it over again. And when it came out of trade, I had to buy it. And one thing I really like about the omnibus that I'm flipping through right now is at the end, it actually has all the, what they call them, X-Facts. So they used to have, instead of like a letters page, or maybe it was with a letters page, I can't remember, but they had a general kind of two-page thing about what was going on in the X office at the time, and it had the wish list, so telling you all the other X books that were coming out, and it had, like in the first one, it was all like, enter now the Age of Apocalypse, and it was kind of having people trying to make you excited about where the different books were going to go, what this new adventure was. You go to like the next month, and it has like the February one from 95. Again, it has like a question about, you know, which of these characters is you know, in this books now. Like, it has some trivia, gives you a cover showcase, and then you go to the next one, and it has, you know, where have all the other heroes gone. It's you know, amping up and making you want to read X Universe, and then the next one is pumping up and advertising the big ending. And I just love that stuff, because I love that when you get to see what people at the time were actually reading. Like, how were you get to, you didn't go online to a message board or know really what was going on from, you know, going online. That wasn't really a thing in 95. So you got it from these promotional pages, and I love that the omnibus includes them, because it makes me feel more like I'm right back where I was when I was 11 years old, sitting outside in, you know, in the spring, reading these comics, sharing them with my friends. And I mean, that's obviously nostalgia, but you know, people have acknowledged that, you know, there's a lot good here. The fact that everything kind of does have a purpose. These characters do kind of, these stories end up converging and explaining and telling this bigger, grander story, and they just do so much. And it just feels so balls to the wall that they're not afraid of taking chances and some big swings. And like, there's so many cool things in here that have been replicated or try to be used in other pieces of canon or in just other places, because it's such cool ideas. Like having, you know, Sabretooth being kind of a good guy. Like, at the time he was in the mansion and just got a claw through his brain, but this is, what if, you know, he was actually a good guy? Like, that's kind of cool. What if Magneto was a good guy? And it's also, you know, what, it's a play on the whole idea of what is one man's worth. If one man dies and it's traumatic and it means something to the person who watched him die, this man saves his life and then he gives up his life for him, what does that mean for someone like Magneto to change his entire worldview because now he's trying to pay off a debt he can never repay? And that the entire universe changes because of it. It's just, I don't know, I really, really love The Age of Apocalypse. I cannot help myself. Again, I've talked about it in my own show at some point. I think it was like episode 200, I could be wrong. But I will always go back to it with fond memory. I don't know when I'm ever going to let my son read it, because it is very violent, but it's definitely something I love.
Good pick. I wholeheartedly agree, and I didn't even think about that as an event, but it definitely was an event. What do you got next?
All right. So I'm getting all the easy ones for me out of the way. So I can't help myself. When you're talking about people, you know, what your first event is, my first real event was Onslaught. To the point where I am sick in the head about wanting to buy it as many times as possible. For example, I own it, I believe, digitally, but I could be wrong about that. I'm pretty sure I do. But if I don't, I do own it, the original singles for Onslaught. I have the complete epic Onslaught trades they put out. I have the omnibus. And then every day this week, I've been thinking about, do I need the Milestones version of Onslaught? Probably not, but I'm thinking about it. Do I need the new three-volume set of the X-Men/Avengers Onslaught series?
Is it three, is it three volumes? I thought it was just two volumes. I have the first volume.
No, there's a third.
Really? Is it like a post-Onslaught trade?
I have no idea what's in it. All I know is that it exists.
Okay. Continue. Sorry.
Or, sorry, it will exist. It's not out yet, so it will exist.
Okay.
So have you read this?
I have not read this, but I am purchasing all of the I have all of the things leading up to it. Those older trades, I found those at BMV. If those listening, if they don't know what BMV is, it's a local bookstore that also has a very extensive comic book section for whether it's back issues or trades. So I found them there on the cheap, and I got them all. So I'm ready to
read this. Yeah, so you have the Road to Onslaught books.
Yes, and I have the first X-Men Avengers Onslaught that they just released, Volume 1.
Okay, do you also have X-Men Prelude to Onslaught?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure. Because you're going to be missing some material.
Okay. I think I do. I think I have everything leading up to it. But I could be wrong.
Because I could be wrong as well. But I feel like the Road to didn't end up having everything that was in the – or I could be wrong. Maybe I'm just missing – no, I think I'm not wrong. Anyways, I might be wrong. I hope that you don't need the prelude because it would be annoying that if you missed out on a book from like 2010. I'm excited for you to read Onslaught. So I was – again, this came out – what year did I say Onslaught was? 96. So I would have been 12 most that year. My birthday's in November, so I would have been 12 most of the year when I was reading Onslaught. So I had just started picking up Uncanny X-Men on the regular. I started with issue 332. 333 is actually the first appearance of Bastion, who would end up being a big player a year later in Operation Zero Tolerance. Issue 334 was this big issue with awesome artwork by Joe Madureira, where you have Juggernaut showing up on the deck. I'm spoiling a little bit, but not too much, hopefully, where he shows up and he needs Jean Grey's help. And then that goes directly into an issue of X-Men, which I had also just started picking up with issue 53. And then suddenly we're right into Onslaught. And I was just like, whoa, what is happening? This is awesome. And for a while there, I only read kind of those two books, X-Men and Uncanny X-Men. But I love the letters pages, and I don't think those are reprinted in the omnibus. But what I loved about them is that similar to what they'd done during Age of Apocalypse, they had these really nice kind of summary pages of what was kind of going on in the Marvel Universe. But what I really liked is that they had these pages where it kind of told you what the phase books were and what the impact books were. So basically what this meant is that it was laying it out for any reader that they could easily understand that the impact books were the books that were affected by the crossover but were not instrumental in understanding the crossover. Whereas if you read the phase books, those were, I think, phase 1 and 2. And I don't know if there's a phase 3 or not, but those actually laid out the books that were important, which I feel like they should do more these days because you end up reading all these things that don't really matter a lot, and it's kind of a waste of your time. But if they just kind of told you and said, okay, here you go, here's the phase this and phase that, these are the impacts, I think people in general would be a lot more appreciative of events and less annoyed. I think people get annoyed by events because they feel like they're just kind of thrust on you, you don't really know what's important, and then you buy a lot of stuff that means nothing.
Right. Now, do you feel having this one in an omnibus form is as good as having the Age of Apocalypse, or is it just overload? Because this is a huge omnibus.
It's amazing.
Okay, where does this – if you had to pick between Age of Apocalypse and Onslaught, which one would you pick?
I mean, I think for story-wise, I think Age of Apocalypse is probably better, but in terms of – like my nostalgic connection to it, I think I would pick Onslaught every time. There's just something to it. It was my first, you know, it was my first real event that I was actually partaking in. I knew what was going on and knew what the players were. Age of Apocalypse, I didn't really get it, but I knew it was awesome. Whereas, you know, and because again, the art was really cool, it was really exciting, and it was edgy. But Onslaught felt like, you know, I was the Marvel Universe was opening up to me, and I was able to kind of experience it through this event that was happening first in the, you know, main X-Men books, but then was, you know, kind of branching out into all these others. So I think for me, there's just something always so magical about that first. This is my first real event that I got to experience. So for me, I think it would always be Onslaught. Is it better? Maybe not, but that's not really the point. It's the one that I love.
Right. So they're going to be now reprinted in 3 volumes to a new reprint of them all. Is what you...
Yes.
Okay.
And it's so interesting because it comes out like the same within the same year as having a Milestones version of it. So the Milestones version of it, when I look at the actual listing of the books that are in it, it's mm-hmm. basically just got, as I said, all those phase books, the books that mattered. So it has, you know, the Uncanny X-Men. It actually has a little bit extra because only, if you can imagine, only 2 issues of Uncanny X-Men were actually part of Onslaught.
Right.
Issue that they in that Milestones version, you have 2 issues that lead into it, but they aren't actually part of the event proper. And one of them is an epilogue issue. The same thing is true of the X-Men issues. You have, you know, issue 54, pretty important. That's the big reveal. Issue 55 and 56 are actually in the event. 57 is just an epilogue. You have Onslaught X-Men was the one shot that kind of really kicked it all off. You have Onslaught Marvel Universe, which ended it all. You got Onslaught Epilogue, which kind of took place a little bit later, but a few months afterwards. And then you have an issue of Avengers, one of Fantastic Four, one of Wolverine, and one of Cable. So that's it. That's the strip down. That's actually what you need and to really understand the main story. But, you know, we're collectors. We want to know everything. So if you buy X-Men Avengers Onslaught, you're going to get a lot more than that. You get, like, extra issues of Cable. You get issues of X-Men, X-Force, like tons of stuff. And again, they kind of distribute it throughout the different volumes. Again, I remember seeing the third volume mentioned somewhere in like a Hachette catalog or something. It's not on Amazon as far as I can tell.
No, I don't see it there.
And I'm not even sure what it would include, because it does look like most of the rest of the event is covered in the second volume, but it doesn't have the concluding chapter. So there's still other stuff that they haven't included there. So you are basically buying 3 volumes, my friend, instead of 2.
So could it be the Onslaught aftermath that they already have that is out? Is that what is left on the cutting room floor from the second volume?
I don't think so. Well, I mean, yes, but there's also at least 1 issue of X-Men. There's, I think, 1 issue of Uncanny X-Men. There's an issue of Fantastic Four. Like, there's probably enough.
Okay. Okay, well, I got to stay on the lookout now. Now I'm thinking I should just have gotten the X-Men Milestones to get the main story. But again, I want to read the whole thing, so I'm a sucker.
And there's a lot of fun stuff here because, I mean, again, I don't know. Like, how much do you know about the events that I'm not spoiling it completely for you?
I know enough about them, but not every beat. But I know, okay. I know the gist of them.
A lot of the Marvel Universe becoming involved is because there is an invasion of Manhattan by Sentinels. That's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't, like, that's not really ruining anything for you. There are Sentinels around. And so a lot of heroes are in New York, so they're going to fight them. So you got a lot of fun stuff that, you know, you get Ben Reilly fighting against Sentinels. You have, which does lead to a moment that feels very like, oh man, we're going to get to see Spider-Man kick some ass in this event, and then it never happens.
Right, right.
Okay. But yeah, no, I mean, you get to see all the, you know, the Marvel Universe reacting to all the stuff that's going on. It's a lot of fun. Again, there are parts of it that are maybe not as good, but and it definitely goes in a weird direction right at the end, in terms of, you know, it making maybe the most amount of sense. But a lot of the buildup makes, you know, it's pretty cool. You know, what happens when you take, you know, one of the most powerful mutants and he goes bad? That's a cool concept. Let's go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you had the one where if you killed the same mutant, what would happen? And then this one, if he happened to go back. So, spoiler, Professor Xavier being at the center of these 2 major events is kind of something that they have in common. And it just kind of goes to show you the power that one character can have. Even today, you look at House of X, Powers of 10, and you that character being back and being a major player again just kind of shows you the mileage you can get out of this one character who's been confined to a wheelchair the majority of his comic book publishing life. And it's kind of cool what different writers can do with them.
Yeah, oh, for sure. So, I mean, I know that some people would go, Onslaught, really? But I don't care.
You shouldn't. It's your list. It's
got, you know, again, you have great artists here. You have the end of the DeFalco Fantastic Four run because, you know, like he was just, you know, basically just tidying it up before it ended. You had the end of a lot of these characters because it was the last time we'd see them in their own books before they went into the Heroes Reborn universe. You know, this ended up being maybe a more important event after it was over than maybe even we realized when it was happening, because I don't know how plugged in everyone would have been at the time about what was about to happen with the Image guys taking, you know, the main Marvel characters that aren't Spider-Man or the X-Men and putting them in a different universe. Like, that was, you know, I don't know how common knowledge it was that this huge thing was going to happen and how they were going to get there. Right. And this is the event that sees it. It's got one of my favorite panels of any issue as well. It's by Andy Kubert. It's from X-Men 55, which I still have the original issue. You have this great page where this guy wakes up. He's in New York. He opens up his window, and he sees a Sentinel face. And you're like, whoa, that's crazy. And then you flip the page. It's this beautiful two-page shot of just Sentinels taking Manhattan. And it's awesome because it's Andy Kubert, and that guy does not fail. This never disappoints.
Absolutely, yeah. I just finished Fatal Attractions, and that scene where Wolverine goes up to face-to-face with Magneto is still... I knew it was going to happen. I was spoiled for years ahead of time, but it still packs a punch.
Yeah, and so I think when you read it, I hope you have a good time with it. The Phase books, I definitely feel like there's more of an urgency to them because, again, there's a main story going on. They're trying to do something urgently. They're trying to protect different characters, and then things all go pear-shaped. But it has a very special place in my heart.
Nice. So two X-Men-centric events so far.
I know.
That's okay. Know. Hey, they could all be X-Men. I have no problem with that. What do you got next?
So... surprisingly enough, and this took a long time to really whittle down, I've decided that my next three are actually all DC related. So I'm done with Marvel.
Okay.
So I'm not sure which order to go in with them, so I'll just pick one. First one is the Sinestro Corps War. I'm going to call that an event. It was a crossover. It wasn't too large, but it was really well put together. It was mainly between two books, and it also had some tales of the Sinestro Corps one-shots that kind of mattered to the overall kind of story. But it was a, you know, relatively simple story compared to the one that would come after it, the sequel, Blackest Night, which was too fucking large. But this is a relatively small story, but it never lets up a punch. I remember to this day when I got that last chapter in Green Lantern 25, and it's like a giant triple-size issue. And I remember I was going back to work. It was like hot summer day and just flipping page after page. I'm like, I cannot get through this fast enough. It's so good. I could not tear myself away from the page. I remember feeling this sense of excitement, this rush, because I was like, I don't know where they're going to go with this. I don't know how this is going to end. Have you read this?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. I would say, because I'm going to spoil some stuff, and I'm like, well, I'd rather not spoil for Eric if possible.
No, I've read this.
But like, there's a great sequence at the end there where you have, Kyle Rayner and Hal Jordan are fighting Sinestro, and their rings are all spent, and then, like, Sinestro's just like, they'll bring it on them. Like, he doesn't care. He doesn't need a ring, and it's just him facing off against both of them, and just a physical, like, you know, just brute force, just punching each other, and they're, like, jumping through buildings. And it's just so badass, and I just remember at the time being like, I want to read this every day. Like, this is amazing.
Yeah, that was one of the books that I was collecting. I bought them all in trade because I think the series was well underway when I had gotten back into comics in 2006, right after I think it was Infinite Crisis and Civil War were the two events of that time. And I started to buy Green Lantern, all of the trades, and when it came out in hardcover, I bought it immediately and I would read them in one sitting, and Green Lantern became one of my absolute favorite characters in comic books during this time. And I've always had a soft spot for the character because of this particular run. It's just fantastic. And Sinestro Corps War was probably the thing that is going to be most remembered from that run. Blackest Night was a huge build up that, you know, a lot of people loved, and it paid off for a lot of people. But Sinestro Corps War, I don't know anybody who's read that and said that it sucked.
So, oh yeah, there's not one piece of that ever felt wasted. And again, it was interesting because you had the main Green Lantern book, you had Green Lantern Corps, they were dovetailing perfectly. You had, like, it felt like a war. Like, and it's interesting if you think about it. It's not, I'm trying to remember the year it came out. But like, it's not so in and around the same time that you're getting like Annihilation over at Marvel, which was a great event too, but I decided not to pick one of those, which again felt like an actual war. Like you were, there was losses, you saw progression. And so in the Green Lantern Sinestro Corps war, you definitely got that as well. You had this feeling of they're fighting this war. There's losses on both sides. You have, you know, Mogo, you have ranks fighting each other. You have this idea of this prophecy that Alan Moore had seeded a long time earlier. Like, it just felt like it was all building something awesome. And it was a great conclusion.
Yeah. And this was my first introduction to what would become a comic collecting lifelong love of Geoff Johns. When I read this book and I would see his name attached to other stuff, because of this book, I started to pay closer attention to what creators were doing with other books, and kind of seeing that trend of, even with Brian Michael Bendis on the other side of the street with Marvel, you kind of start to see the trend of creators being the forces behind the story, as opposed to me just following a character because I love the character. So yeah, the great pick. Sinestro Corps was a phenomenal story.
What's interesting too is that, to go back to it, like I remember like when that first came out, like no one really knew what it was going to be. Like we were getting lead up for a while, which was exciting, but we didn't really know where it was going to go. And when we finally, and again, this is, you know, the event where suddenly the yellow ring isn't just a yellow ring. It's all about fear. Like everything's going to get modified here. But when you get that first one shot and you see the team, like, you know, that's actually, you know, who the Sinestro Corps is actually going to be and what they're going to do. And you see them all together. Like, that is one of my favorite, like, kind of last page reveals, because you think it's going to, you know, it's scary enough when it's going to be, you know, Sinestro, and they really retooled him and made him a scary spot character. But suddenly you realize, oh, that's not even what you think it's going to be. Like, we're going to have so many characters that we never knew we were going to get. Right. We're going to, you know, see the Anti-Monitor again. We're going to see Superboy Prime. We're going to see Cyborg Superman. They're all working for the Sinestro Corps, and you have the Sinestro in service to them. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah, no, it was pretty badass, definitely. Yeah, no, it was a great story.
And one thing I always loved about it, because even though it's a big bombastic story and you got some mm-hmm. awesome stuff with like Sodom Yacht, and you have Superboy Prime, all this cool stuff, there's also some surprising amount of emotion, because yes. I remember when reading in that last issue, and you have the whole point of Cyborg Superman being part of this is that he wants to die. He is cursed. He cannot die. And so he just wants to die. And there's this shot where I think he's with the Anti-Monitor and they're all being blasted, and he looks at the Green Lanterns and says, "The Green Lanterns, thank you." And he just looks so like at peace that he's finally going to die. At the end of the issue, he doesn't die. He's still alive. And you see him actually, I think there's actually a tear that he sheds in space, because he thought he finally had it, thought he was finally, you know, going to be free of this cursed existence. And yet it didn't work out after all. And I always thought that was really tragic. I mean, he's obviously a villainous character and you don't really like him, but there was something really profound about when he thanked the Green Lanterns for letting him die. And then he wasn't even granted that, you know, that sweet release. I always thought that was surprisingly emotional.
I got to read this again. It's been a long time since I've gone through that Green Lantern run. This, to put it in perspective to anybody listening, this story was so good that it made DC or Warner Brothers think that they can make a Green Lantern movie work. And I believed it because how good it was. I think on the strength of Geoff Johns' run that they went ahead with a Green Lantern movie. That's how good this run was.
It's so funny. I agree with you. It's so funny because I remember, like, I always liked Hal Jordan. I liked Kyle too, but I was really excited when they said they were going to bring back Hal. So I remember buying Green Lantern Rebirth, and I really liked it. And then I bought the first 8 issues of the Green Lantern book, and I was bored. And I don't know if it was Pacheco's artwork wasn't as dynamic as Ethan Van Sciver's was on Rebirth, but I was just kind of like, this is good, but I'm not really feeling it. So I kind of, like, lapsed on it. And then they started seeding what would become the Sinestro Corps War once they came back from 1 year later. And I remember seeing the artwork by a guy, Ivan Reyes, and being like, oh my God, what is this? Where did this guy come from? And so I missed a bunch of issues. I couldn't buy them in singles. They were selling out. So I remember buying like the 2 trades that kind of made up that difference. And then I bought, starting with the Sinestro Corps War, I'm like, I'm not missing out on this. And I think I bought until maybe a year into the new 52. And I finally said, I'm done. But yeah, like, you know, it made Green Lantern a franchise that people cared about, like that was up there with Batman. Like when the new 52 happened, the only two characters that got to keep their continuities more or less intact was Batman and Green Lantern. And that's a big thing. Like even Superman didn't get to keep his continuity. Yeah. They were happy to, you know, kind of shove everything away. But Batman and Green Lantern, they had to keep. And there's a reason for that. And, you know, this is where I think Geoff Johns really took over in a big way with Green Lantern and really broke through. Like, Rebirth was great and a lot of people loved it. But I think a lot of people like me were kind of like a little lackluster in that first year or so. But then once they came back from 1 year later and you had Ivan Reyes delivering amazing art, suddenly it started to ratchet up and feel more exciting. And you got these backups as we started to learn more about these characters that would become the Sinestro Corps. And you started to get this overwhelming feeling of excitement. There's something grander happening. And then there it was. And it was awesome.
Yeah. I don't know if you've been reading the Brian Michael Bendis Superman. I don't know where it's at currently, but the Ivan Reis artwork in the main Superman title is just beautiful to look at. And it made me think of the stuff that he did with Green Lantern during the time that you're describing. It's just absolutely – he's an incredible artist.
What's hard about reading Bendis on Superman is that you read that and you're like, oh, man, this is amazing. I'm going to go read Action Comics. What has John Romita Jr. done to himself? Like, it's just I can't even look at it.
I haven't gotten there yet in the Action Comics run. I'm way behind on that. I'm just going to collect it in trade, but they're doing that whole hardcover first and then softcover months later. It's driving me nuts. But anyways, let's get back to our list. What's next on your list?
Okay, chronologically wise, it's actually before the last one. But okay. I'm a big fan of Infinite Crisis. I know a lot of people don't like it, or they slag certain elements about the landing maybe not being stuck, but, and I'm not just talking about Infinite Crisis. I'm talking about, you know, the countdown to Infinite Crisis, the different kind of miniseries that were leading up to Infinite Crisis, which felt disparate at the time, but then once they actually got Infinite Crisis, you felt like it pulled them all together, and then you had specials of all those books that kind of brought it all together. You had crossovers of plenty all over the place. I'm a big fan of Infinite Crisis. It takes some big swings. Some of them are good, some of them aren't, but I think more often than not, it makes me excited. I've actually read it to my son. My son loved it. He felt the excitement because it just felt that this big bombastic story with, you know, some big villains and, you know, a lot of action and intrigue. I haven't read him Countdown to Infinite Crisis because I don't need him to have the best Blue Beetle story told and then have him shot in the head. I don't need to do that to my son. But I do think that's the best Blue Beetle story we've ever had. I remember when it came out that year, I loved that one shot. It was so good. And then I was at, a Paradise Comics Con or whatever they called it at the time, the spring convention back in, 2004 or 2005. I remember being at that and just getting a bunch of posters. They were like skinny wall posters and one for each of the four miniseries. I used to have them all up in my room in university because I was such a huge fan of where they were going with this, and reading the OMAC project and reading, which was so phenomenal. And really, like, each one felt so different from each other, but they were all adding up to this grander sense of where the DC universe was going. And I don't think the DC universe has ever felt as cohesive as it did during Infinite Crisis, where everything felt like it was under this roof and every step felt more exciting than the last. So I love Infinite Crisis, not just the main series. I'm talking about everything.
Yeah, no, I think that was a good time as well for DC. Like, I love the series. It definitely paid homage in all the right ways to the original and expanded on those ideas. But even the stuff that was affecting all of the characters and the Justice League and the Superman story with Maxwell Lord, that I thought that was written by Greg Rucka, that tied in with the Wonder Woman. I thought that was some pretty great storytelling as well. And then you even had some of the things that Gail Simone was doing in Secret Six that led up to Infinite Crisis. It was an exciting time. And I agree wholeheartedly with you. Those were some good moments at DC Comics when all the engines I felt were running and things were going in a cohesive place. And even after Infinite Crisis, there was some good stuff, but it quickly derailed by the time they got to 2011.
Now, we kind of disagreed a little because in my heart of hearts, I feel like 52 kind of counts like an event in and of itself because it was 52 issues. The first time anyone really done like a weekly that long sustained with one big mega story, and it absolutely stuck the landing. And I still to this day don't know how they pulled it off so well. I love 52, and that's a comfort read. You have to be willing to put in the time because it's 52 issues. It's not like a small read, but it's exciting. But yeah, Infinite Crisis set that all up. And again, I come from because I started reading comics in the mid-90s, everything, like, there was so much going on, and you did not know, but I was never scared of that. When when I was younger. I was always just so excited about it. And I liked to see editor's notes and have them reference things. Be like, oh, man, if I picked up that issue, I'd know what was going on here and I'd know what was going on there. And it's kind of like this giant tapestry, this soap opera component that's very exciting. So reading Infinite Crisis and all these different stories and all the different continuity that was being plumbed as they put together the story, like there was no stone unturned. They pulled everyone in. And again, all those, you know, you had was the Day of Judgment or Day of Vengeance was the kind of the magic one. You had the OMAC project that I mentioned before, which dovetails with Sacrifice, which was the Superman Wonder Woman story. You had Villains United and the Rand Vanagar War, which at the time I thought was kind of the run to the bunch. But whenever I go back to it, I'm like, this is exciting stuff. Like, what was I thinking? And again, it all led to something. And, you know, again, when I read it now, it still feels like it pops. The artwork's fantastic. It does get a little sloppier near the end. They had trouble meeting deadlines. There was a lot more fill-ins and here and there. So maybe it's not the most cohesive from an artistic standpoint, but I still think it's a thrill ride, you know? And again, I read it with my son and I could see him getting like really invested and excited. I had to, you know, maybe make it look like Superman Prime wasn't outright murdering people because that should be censored. But I mean, but for the most part, like a lot of it still tracks, you know, and it's a story of hope. But it's also a story of losing one's way, of wanting something so bad that you forget why you wanted it in the first place and you're willing to sacrifice too much that maybe you don't deserve what you wanted. There's so much in there. And again, you have the heroes at a place where, you know, they didn't trust each other anymore, which comes off of, you know, previous events like Identity Crisis, et cetera. And it felt like everything that had been happening in the DC universe for like the 2 years previous, it all mattered. It all built to this. And again, I'd be hard pressed to find another time in DC history where they did it this well. I mean, you had Blackest Night was, you know, again, leading to it for years, but that was one side of the universe that then bubbled over, but it wasn't like everything was in concert leading up to it, whereas this was.
Yeah. And this changed the game again. This was another point of reference where you have, I think, Crisis on Infinite Earths, whereas like it was the original proper rebirth of DC. Line-wide, it changed everything and was a great starting point for anybody to want to read comics that was familiar with the characters but was pressing the refresh button that desperately needed to happen in some ways. And then it culminates with Infinite Crisis, where all of the things that occurred at Crisis on Infinite Earths are still, they still matter, they still counted. It was very nice. The whole universe was still felt, it came full circle with this story. And I think the whole tapestry of the DC universe feels like it culminates here.
I agree. And what's nice about afterwards is, again, 52 is a fantastic story. But then you also have all the 1 year later stuff, which is a lot of fun, a lot of it, because they're basically tasked with, let's put your characters in all new situations. A year has occurred. Let's just, throw them into the stuff. And I think the original idea was that you would see more of that reflected in 52. And then I think as 52 progressed, it was a little bit more insular about the characters it was focusing on. Again, I don't have any problem with that because I love the stories that they decided to tell in 52, so I'm okay with it. But you had, you know, suddenly Green Arrow was the mayor. Like, whoa, what happened here? Like, you had all this stuff. You had the Batman universe felt like it was refreshed. You had Harvey Dent had been, you know, kind of taking over for Batman while Batman was gone for a year, and he was, you know, he was cured, and then in the first storyline back, of course, he becomes Two-Face again. But you had a lot of kind of pushing characters in new directions that was exciting because, you know, the conceit was, you know, a year has passed, we can slowly fill in things later, but let's just, you know, jump forward and have fun. And again, we were moving away from every shared piece of continuity needed to matter. But again, I think a lot of the 1 year later stories were fun because you got to put characters in new situations coming out of Infinite Crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Another good pick. What else you got? What's next?
All right. So this is the last one technically of the six that I brought to bear here. And this one, I don't have a lot of issues in front of me. I have trades somewhere in my basement. And again, this one's kind of a cheat, but I think you'd say it still counts as an event, even though it took up so much real estate. And this is Batman No Man's Land. It's absolutely sprawling. It's huge. It took a year's worth of Batman issues to tell it. Not just Batman, but like every Bat title under the sun. I mean, if you've watched Dark Knight Rises, you kind of have an idea of this. But it's much worse than it is in the comics. In the comics, it all starts with Cataclysm, which is a great kind of disaster film made in a Batman universe, which is the right place to put it, because Batman is very fallible. He's not a superhero. He's not a superpowered hero. And suddenly, Gotham City is struck by a massive earthquake. Thankfully, you know, Batman's buildings seem to be the only safe ones because they were Wayne tech proofed, but everything else is kind of falling apart. Batman has to do what he can to kind of stop everyone from losing their minds and going crazy. But how do you put together a broken city? You can't. And then there's this long kind of road to no man's land where slowly they end up deciding that they're going to cut off Gotham from the rest of the United States. They're kind of declaring a disaster zone. Some people stay. Bruce Wayne kind of disappears. Batman disappears for a while. No one knows what's going on. You have a lot of cops, the Blue Boys, who stay behind. And then you have all these different gangs that start taking over with different, you know, supervillains kind of leading most of them. And then Batman, you know, decides, I'm coming back. I'm going to save my city. And that's what No Man's Land is all about. How do you, you know, try to take back a city that has been destroyed and you know, fight all these villains, et cetera. And how do you take back and fight against anarchy and really, you know, bring back civilization? And it is a year's worth of stories. It is not, you know, a small thing. It is massive, but it's enormously satisfying. You have, you know, every character there. You have a lot of major characters in there. You have like a new Batgirl at the time who was actually, well, I guess I shouldn't spoil it, but it was someone who was not actually Batgirl. Then you have the Cassandra Cain Batgirl being, you know, introduced as well. So a lot of exciting things happening in and out. It's massive. It's, I think, from 1999. It collected in, I think, three or four big trades. There's a bunch of other trades that are the Road to No Man's Land trades, which are actually coming out in an omnibus format soon. It's massive. It's exciting. It's not for the faint of heart, because there are some extremely dire, upsetting stories that are told within both Cataclysm and No Man's Land that there's not always a happy ending for.
I do not own this series.
Really?
Yeah, but I haven't ever read it in comic form, but I did read the novel.
Okay, interesting. I've never read the novel, so I can't confirm just how much it kind of excises or doesn't include, but I would imagine it has a lot of the salient beats.
The thing, too, is that the novel oftentimes includes, with all the prose that's in there, that it explains a lot of feelings, emotions, scenes that you kind of conjure up in your mind, of course, that you don't get in comic book format. So I've read the whole story in a 500-page prose novel written by Greg Rucka, who was one of the writers on No Man's Land, if memory serves. So I know the story well. I don't remember all of the beats very perfectly because it's been over a decade since I read it, but I did really, really enjoy that story. And when I watched The Dark Knight Rises, I immediately recognized the beats that they were taking from No Man's Land, as well as the one of my favorite parts, and I don't know if this was in the comic, I'm sure it was, but there was that moment where Commissioner Gordon and Batman have that chat when he returns back to Gotham and he's about to reveal his identity to him. And Commissioner Gordon is very disappointed with the fact that Batman had been away for so long and had felt abandoned by him, if memory serves. And I thought that was a very memorable part of that story for me, reading it in prose form.
I would agree it is. I mean, if we're ever allowed to see each other again and leave our homes, I can always like lend you this stuff. Again, they're big trades, but
I have them on digital. I bought it all digitally because I knew it would save a lot of space. That was always kind of my hang up, was where you start and how are you going to store it all? Because to collect it, there's the road to No Man's Land. And of course you've got to read Cataclysm, and then there's the three big trades, and then there's the after No Man's Land. And it was just like, this is too much. I don't know where to start to begin. So let me just get it digitally. They had a big Batman digital sale once and I got them all. So I said, all right, we're good.
Okay, good. It also does include the first in canon DC Universe appearance of Harley Quinn, transitioning finally from the you know, the TV series, where she was just at that point, she'd only ever been in the Batman Adventures comics, which was telling kind of the animated series version of the stories. But finally, she was in the real real DC Universe, and that's where it happened.
That's cool. Yeah, this is one of those I think game changing Batman stories that sometimes, because it's so sprawling and so big, gets doesn't get forgotten. You never forget this story, but I feel there's a lot of great Batman stuff here that, you know, we often think of Batman and it's just Frank Miller Batman. And this is a good example of all of these different writers coming together and putting something that the whole Batman family was affected by. I remember there being crossovers in the Nightwing books and the Robin books. Like, everybody was affected by this, but in a way that was legitimate, where they would have had to have been affected by it. They couldn't not be involved in this crossover.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting, like, when I was compiling my list, a lot of some of the things that did not kind of make this kind of top 5-6 list, and I'm sure if I did this list in 2 months, I'd have different answers. I really thought about stuff like Nightfall. Like, I really like Batman Nightfall, and I think it actually holds together fairly well. There's definitely some fat near the end, but I think the original concept is very strong. If they'd maybe whittled it down a little bit better, it would have been a little bit stronger, maybe. But I think especially like the first part of Nightfall, all about Batman being pushed to his limits and being exhausted, I think really works well for the amount of issues they used. Another event that I really liked, and I really, again, struggled with including it, was Batman Bruce Wayne Murderer, and then Bruce Wayne Fugitive.
Yeah, I have those. Which is, again, I have
sprawling stories.
Great story. Yes. Continue.
And then actually another one I really like that's Batman related, but it's not quite as big, but I always thought it was very strong, like well put together, was Officer Down, which is all about Gordon being shot and what kind of happens after that, and it inadvertently ends up kind of, I think, setting up. I think it made DC realize that Gotham Central as a book could work, because they saw how well Rucka and Brubaker worked on that, on Officer Down, and it really kind of living with those the cop characters a little bit more. And I think that's what kind of gave them the idea that let's do Gotham Central. And when Gotham Central starts, Gordon's not there, and it's because of the events of Officer Down. So it's interesting to kind of go back and see that kind of stuff.
Yeah. All of these Batman things now that I'm looking, that you're referencing, I'm looking them up, like something with like Nightfall. There's so many different variations of how it's been reprinted and collected, and it, you know, you don't know what you're going to be missing out on with each collection that they've redone. What do you say is the best way to do it with the one that you mentioned particularly?
So you mean Nightfall? I think the best way to go for Nightfall is the way I haven't done myself, actually. So some backstory, DC trade paperbacks were some of the first trade paperbacks I used to buy, because I was buying singles at Marvel, so I didn't really need them in trade. Now, if I could go back in time, I'd be like, you idiot, pick these up now. They're never going to be able to find them later. But at the time, I didn't think that way. So some of the first trades I ever had was Batman Nightfall, very old printing. Well, not old at the time, but now when I look back, it's like the mid-90s. And that was my printing of it. And I had that for years. And then they announced they were going to do a reprinting in these big volumes that was, you know, not glossy paper, but these big volumes, was three big volumes. I bought those, was very happy with them. And they announced the omnibuses, and I'm like, I can't do that. I'm not going to buy three giant omnibuses. But it did collect stuff that I didn't have. I believe Knight's Quest, The Search, was something that had always kind of been excised or never included anywhere else, which is pretty important, because all these collections never showed you how Bruce Wayne, you know, got his mobility back. They showed how he was training to take on Azrael, but they didn't actually show how he got his back healed. So I technically don't own that in any trade format. I kept thinking about getting the prelude to Nightfall trade paperback they did a couple years ago, because they decided to recut and do all of Nightfall into kind of smaller trades, which they also did with The Death of Superman, which is another one that was a kind of an honorable mention list for me, where they took The Death and Return of Superman and they kind of, again, chopped it up into smaller trades instead of the kind of the big ones they'd done in the past, which is how I generally collected it. The omnibus or the recut versions is probably the most comprehensive way to read these stories, even though I don't technically have them myself, just because, you know, I wasn't willing to spend the money, and now they're too expensive to spend the money on. So, you know, you snooze, you lose.
Right. I think they did these nice recut versions where they did the three really big volumes of them. And you got, you know, three nice recut volumes that were much better than the original ones that you and I owned. I think we're both talking about those old versions of Nightfall that didn't collect everything. And then they released, they did like a 25th anniversary where they did Nightfall Volume 1, Nightfall Volume 2, and then Night Sen Volume 1. And I'm like, oh, they just split it up into like nine different trades now. So it just became, irritating to think of how to own this thing.
What is nice, though, and I will give them credit, is that they included at the back end of those a lot of stuff that was never included before because it wasn't technically part of Nightfall, but you got stuff like Prodigal, and you had the storylines that came out like right after Batman, you know, Bruce Wayne came back, and he almost immediately went away again, and then Dick Grayson became Batman for a little while. That was all in there and in these recut versions that were not in those big, you know, kind of phone book size versions that you and I have. So it's one of those things that bugs me from time to time, but I just wasn't willing to buy it again. And I find that DC more than Marvel seems to go back to the well and keep recutting those same kind of events because they know people are going to buy Nightfall. They know people are going to buy Death of Superman. So they're going to keep putting them out in these giant omnibuses and they're going to recut them for this anniversary or this or that. And they're going to keep doing it. Whereas I find Marvel generally seems to go down to the well less for those big things. Like some of them, yeah, they might, you know, reprint them, but generally speaking, I don't think they're recutting them constantly. Although, fun story, I will point out that one miniseries, which feels like it's been presented in so many different ways, is Marvels by Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross, which is a beautiful book. I own it in not original trade, but a trade that came out sometime, in the early 2000s. Really enjoyed it. And then they had the Marvel Premier Classic hardcover version, which I bought as well. And then at some point they had the Marvel's Platinum version, which was like this giant, you know, really extremely oversized version. And then there was going to be like a new anniversary cut version. All these versions that came out just in the last couple of years, they kept putting out Marvels, and I never knew which one was the right version to get. What I ended up getting was the 25th anniversary edition because it included the epilogue that they just published last year, which was new, as well as last year they published Marvel's The Annotated Editions, and they had these beautiful new annotations that were done by Alex Ross and Kurt Busiek that were in the back matter. So now in this new hardcover, it has the main original story, right? And then it has, all this back matter, and it has the epilogue, so it kind of had to be, for me, the most complete version of Marvels I could find. But it frustrates me that there's so many out there.
Yeah.
There's people with the 10th anniversary edition. They can throw that away now. People have this giant, platinum size version. They can throw that away now because, it has material that isn't there that is now in this new version. Another one quick point about this as well that actually really bothers me is that when I was looking at my new version, though, I noticed, and I think it's only in the in the prologue, which was, or the zero issue, which was not part of the original series. I don't know if it was maybe a problem with the files, but the font and the placement of the text is different than in the original comic. So when I look at my Premier Classic hardcover and my old trade, it has different placement in the prologue only that I can tell. And that drives me mental. But everything else about it is perfect, and it's an oversized hardcover, not as big as the one that was done in the last 2 years, but it's a gorgeous way to own the book. If you love Marvels, you need to pick this up.
Yeah, I have I think it might have been the 10th anniversary. It was a very expensive version of it that I found at a Comic-Con that was very, very cheap. And it takes up a lot of shelf space. It has, I think, a lot of scripting and back matter in it. So I'm happy that I have it, but the new, what you just described, having it like a nice, complete, full story is tempting. But we'll see. We'll see what happens when comic shops and everything opens back up again, where you can actually order something and know when it's coming. But that was fun, and that was a very good list of events to kind of reflect and go back into your collection and reread during the downtime that we currently have, which, you know what, it's good to sometimes have that downtime to reflect on the stuff that you want to revisit to give you that feeling of comfort. This is a good time to reflect on that stuff. So good list. I want to read Onslaught now.
Well, you may hate me later, but we'll see. Probably can I not. Just for a quick, very quickly, just kind of talk about some of the other kind of honorable mentions that I had in my list? I won't take too much time, I promise.
Okay, go ahead. Go for it.
Okay, so as I mentioned, I already had Nightfall, Night's End, and Death of Superman, Funeral for a Friend, Reign of the Superman. Love those. Again, I was very young when they were coming out. I had a few sporadic issues, but it always stuck with me. I remember this summer that Reign of Superman came out, being able to find a few issues here and there was so exciting, and then being able to eventually, years later, read it all in one place was the most exciting feeling at the time because, again, that little kid who was so excited to just see whatever issues he could find finally got to read it all, and it was very exciting. What else we got in this list? We got Batman War Games. It's kind of this this storyline that no one likes to talk about anymore, but it was in three major acts. It was pretty big at the time. It was all the Bat books. Basically, spoiler, steals something from Batman and wants to prove herself to him. She used to be Robin. Now she's not. She's back to being spoiler. So she decides she's going to run his war game scenario as a way of kind of bringing everyone in Gotham down. However, there's one character missing, matches Malone, but she can't figure out where he is. Because obviously it's Batman, but she doesn't know that. And everything goes pear-shaped. The entire city explodes into violence. Black Mask, becomes a huge thorn in the side here. Oracle's base of operations gets completely damaged and destroyed, and someone dies. And Batman's relationship with the Gotham PD changes for years. It's very exciting. There's a reason why Batman doesn't get along that well with the police in Gotham Central, and it comes off of this. I've always loved this event. A lot of crazy, weird characters like Onyx and Orpheus. And if you don't know who they are, that's what I mean. Like, there's weird characters here, but it's one hell of a ride.
Nice. Were those? Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Please.
No, I was going to say were those the two, but you have some more, so keep going.
Oh, I mean, I could go on for years, but I won't. We got Acts of Vengeance, which is a classic Marvel crossover back in the day. Again, not necessarily a crossover in the way we're used to, because the main story was only a few issues of Avengers. Basically, you have a bunch of villains come together. They decide that they're going to kind of swap enemies, and they're going to hopefully have better success because their regular arch foes know them. So let's go against someone who doesn't know us. But then everyone in the Marvel Universe gets involved. You get some eclectic, weird matchups. Super fun. There's two omnibuses that exist, and I think they're hard to find now. I think it's been republished a couple times in different smaller trades. It's a lot of fun if you can pick it up. We've got Annihilation I mentioned earlier, and Annihilation Conquest. And really, there's like a bunch of events that have been put into giant omnibuses comprising this era of the Marvel Cosmic, but those first two are kind of the inciting incidents, the one that really make you believe that the Cosmic Place can really be pulled together and be just as exciting and put together in terms of continuity as the best kind of New York-centered storyline. Operation Galactic Storm, again, so many issues. This was a big moment for the Avengers. This is kind of like the Civil War that came before Civil War in terms of there being a giant schism between the Avengers, those who are willing to kill and those who aren't, which is, again, a very exciting premise. And it's a spiritual successor to the Kree-Skrull War. If you go back to the X-Men side, you got Mutant Massacre, the first X crossover, the crossover that started a million. You got Inferno, the one that felt like would never end. A more modern one, you got Messiah Complex, which has, it's not maybe the best consistent storyline, but it has some brilliant moments. There's some moments there with Cable that to this day are probably some of my favorite Cable moments. There's a moment with Scott Summers and Cable at the very end, which again, I always felt very emotional about, especially now being a parent. Definitely kind of hit me as well. Operation Zero Tolerance, that's the rosy, color of nostalgia. Love it. It's not necessarily great. I think that if it was done now, it could be done better. I think they weren't willing to go as far with it as they could. And I think if you saw it in a modern comic, it would probably be more visceral, you'd see more ramifications, and it would feel more permanent. But the ideas behind it are really good. It's basically, we've always been talking about, the Sentinels coming for the mutants. What if they really came for them and they had full government backing and the X-Men have no choice but to go to ground? And that's what this is, and it's exciting as fuck. Sorry to swear.
It's okay. Hey, you got where it's appropriate, you got to use it. I have those trades now, the Operation Zero Tolerance, and I got very good retro reviews, actually, off of Adventures in Poor Taste. They gave it a perfect 10, so you're not alone in loving
it. Wow.
Yeah. You're not alone in loving that series. So I got a lot of X-Men that I'm looking forward to reading. I'm on this thing where I feel like I got to read it all in order, and sometimes that's a bigger undertaking than I'm prepared for, but I'm going to do it. I've gotten all the way to Fatal Attractions now, so I'm on my way to Blood Ties. Go ahead.
Oh, Blood Ties. Oh, my God. So Blood Ties is on sale on the Comixology right now. There's a buy one, get one. I think that expires today. So I picked it up. I have it in the Marvel Premier Classic hardcover. I have it in the original trades. At the original issues. I have it digital now. I love Blood Ties. It's not very good, but I love it.
Well, I have it in the Marvel, the hardcover, not the omnibus, but the very large hardcover, The Wedding of Cyclops and Phoenix, that's included in there. So that was part
of... Oh, really? Okay.
That was part of the reason why I felt that this non-omnibus was worth having, because it collects quite a bit of material that I would want to read in a different format. So if I can read it all here with that, that continuity where everything should be, it's just nice to have it in one easy package. But yeah, that's next in the storyline, because I'm onto that hardcover now. So it was just one. I read all of Fatal Attractions. I really enjoyed it. And then I just said, okay, let me take a break from X-Men, because I did, it again, a non-omnibus hardcover, which is 800 pages of X-Men, which was a very fun, very fun story, very exciting, and a game changer. But I'm like, okay, maybe I'll go somewhere else for a little bit. But I'm looking forward to reading Onslaught and Operation Zero Tolerance, as well as even the Phalanx Covenant. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, a lot of it's, fun. And a lot of it does have, even if you're not really enjoying all the stories, you get some amazing artwork out of it. And kind of, sometimes vice versa. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff there, And it's interesting. There's so many events I didn't talk about from the kind of the 2000s, because a lot of them were fun, but... I don't know, they were good, but there was always felt like there was something missing, or they didn't quite stick the landing for me. Whereas I felt like a lot of these other ones did, or they were a little bit more consistent. I think a lot of the Bendis written ones always for me felt like, he's so good at setting up a story. I just don't always know if he's good at actually ending the story. Like, I think he's one of the best setup guys in comics, but I don't know if he's a finisher.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, that's why I think something like, Avengers vs. X-Men kind of stuck that landing, in the sense that it changed the landscape, because it wasn't just him at the helm. It was him, Jason Aaron, I think Brubaker as well. It was like written by committee, but done in a way where the whole story felt completed by the end of it.
Mm.
So I don't know if that
had... You didn't mention any of your own that would be on the list. This was kind of me taking center stage here, but what would you put on the list?
Well, Sinestro Corps would have been on my list. Civil War from that. Mm-hmm. I think that's one that I could read again and again. And it's kind of a timeless event for anybody wanting to just pick up a comic book with the Marvel universe and getting a sense of people's relationships and where they were and where they end up. It's kind of like one of those turning points in the Marvel universe. Crisis on Infinite Earths is just the nostalgia of George Perez artwork and seeing... It was kind of like the original Jonathan Hickman version of the Avengers, where all of these worlds are colliding and disappearing, and who's going to stay, and to what sacrifices are made in order to maintain some sense of reality. But just the moments in that book where, the Flash dying, spoilers for 30 years, 45 years later, Supergirl, all of those moments where, and just the artwork, it's just a beautiful book to look at. What else did I have on my list? Of course, Infinity Gauntlet is so philosophical, and again, George Perez artwork with all of the Marvel universe. I know he didn't complete the series, but that's quite a great story to look back on. It definitely is a product of its time, but the mileage that it's had, just for the fact that they built the entire MCU to have a version of that story, is just kind of shows the impact of that story. What else did I have? I think there's a lot of DC events that I'm probably a little bit more familiar with, because I was a longtime DC reader. But Infinite Crisis was there as well. What else did I have on my list? Let me take a look at my phone. I wrote a couple down, but I think that was the main ones that came to my head.
Zero Hour?
Yeah, you know what? I really enjoyed Zero Hour when I was reading like an issue of Robin or an issue of Batman back then, and seeing all of these things in the timeline be all screwed up. The main story was a little bit confusing. I remember I was very excited to read it when it was in trade, and I finally got to read this series and see what it was all about. But it doesn't, I don't know, it doesn't resonate with me to the point where I was like, oh, that was fantastic. It was okay. It was fun. You know which one was actually good? I don't know if it's considered an event or just a mini series, but Cosmic Odyssey. Jim Starlin, Mike Mignola. That's a really cool story. That wasn't a line wide crossover, but it was a pretty cool event. That was kind of nice. But
DC also has DC 1 million. I mean, that was another huge one.
Yeah. Death of Superman, of course, was huge for me. But I'm not sure if that's, again, that's why I was asking. Would a character line wide event be constituted as that, or would it be something like Infinite Crisis or a Final Crisis? Something like that. You know what I mean?
Superman affected enough. It was enough books, and plus it was like a national news story. I feel like it's an event.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good way to put it. Nightfall, I liked as a kid. I'm not sure where I put it now, but you know what? A lot of those X-Men stuff that I've been reading recently, that are older stories, I really enjoyed reading them. I enjoyed reading Inferno, as long as that sucker was, and it felt like it was never going to end, and it tied every book here, there, and another tied into it. The main story was pretty cool. What was one? I just had one at the tip of my tongue. Secret Wars from Hickman. That one was pretty fantastic, especially because it was such a build-up for so many years. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of one more that I had, but now I forgot it, so I guess it wasn't that important.
I mean, House of X. Crisis in Infinite Earth, which is obviously one of the first events, and I would think you have to mention the original Marvel Superhero Secret Wars as well, because those were the first two of their kind in terms of real big events for their universes. Go ahead, what were you going to mention?
I was going to say House of X. I don't know if that's considered an event. I feel like it was, because it's changed the landscape of the industry in a way for the last year. People were really excited about X-Men again, and as a 12-issue series that now spins off into all these other X-Men books, I feel like that was really spectacular. But Secret Wars from the original one, I never actually read it.
What?
I know. I have it. I own it. I've never read it yet. It's like a vacation read.
I was going to say, what are you doing?
Yeah, man? I know. It's sacrilege. I'm going to read it, though. I know all the beats. I know the important things that happen in it, but I am going to read it just to say that I've actually gone through it. Definitely.
Okay, good. Because it's crazy that you haven't.
I know. I always see, it's one of those things where people are always like, oh, it was just a commercial to sell toys, and then some people just absolutely love it, and people still reference it, and it's one of those things that you just got to read it at least once. But I'm sure I'll probably love it, knowing me. I don't care if it's a toy commercial. I still love that classic superhero and Mike Zeck artwork. I mean, come on, can't go wrong.
I mean, you're gonna read it, and you're gonna want to buy those toys, and you're gonna know it worked.
It's true. Well, thank you so much for doing this with me. It's always fun chatting comics with you. We could talk into the wee hours of the morning, and we probably will do this a lot more in the near future. And I hope to be on a Comic Shenanigans episode in the near future as well. Thanks, dude.
Oh, for sure. Just invite yourself on, man. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it. Maybe we'll continue our list on your show. Sounds good. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening to The Cave of Solitude. I hope everybody is at home staying safe and sound with all of your families during this time. If you are listening to the podcast, I hope we're giving you content that you enjoy. Make sure you check out Comic Shenanigans as well. Leave us both a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you download your podcasts, and you can follow us also both on Facebook. So once again, this is Eric Anthony and Mr. Adam Chapman. Thank you for coming on the show, and everybody have a good night, and once again, stay safe and stay healthy.